chapter 10. It's called Free Will. And I want to start with a little story, which some of you might be familiar with, because it made headlines in June of 2012, not so long ago, because from 2003 to 2012, there was a leader in a radical right-wing part of the Hungarian parliament. It was called the Jobbik Party. It was a terribly anti-Semitic party in Hungary. And the head of this party, Senad Szegedi, that's his name. I don't know if that rings a bell. So his name is Senad Szegedi, and he was notorious for his anti-Semitism and extreme nationalism, and his party got a lot of bad press and media because of their pretty racist views. In June of 2012, and this is when it all came out, he revealed that he actually was Jewish. He learned literally a few weeks before that his maternal grandparents were Jewish, and therefore that he was a Jew, and learned also his grandmother had actually survived Auschwitz. All of this was kept from him for various reasons I don't need to go into right now. But he was living in this crazy kind of dialectic of preaching a certain hate and enmity for the Jewish people, other ethnicities as well, but particularly against the Jews, and then finds out that he's a Jew himself, and that his own grandmother was a survivor. What does he do? What do you do? This doesn't happen every day. When you wake up after being an antisemite for so long, and you wake up finding out that you're a Jew yourself. You know what he did? He met with a rabbi. He wanted to explore his Jewish roots, believe it or not. And in August of 2012, he apologized to the rabbi. He appointed the rabbi as the representative of the Jewish people and apologized to the rabbi for all of his anti-Semitic remarks and policies. He traveled to Israel. He went to the Western Wall and visited the Holocaust Museum, Yad Vashem, in Jerusalem. And he decided ultimately to embrace his Judaism, and he changed his name. He gave himself a Jewish name, David. And he wears a kippah to this day. And he learned how to read and speak Hebrew. And he had a bris milah. He got himself circumcised. He literally went the whole way. And it was an unbelievable thing. And I'm sharing this story because not only so extreme, but the question is, how does somebody go from being A to B? And is it possible to really change? Now, I guess that story seems to indicate change is possible, but the way our society and much of our literature in the world of psychology discusses the concept of free will today, we don't really believe in change anymore. There was an article in the New York Times, it was published, Free Will, Now You Have It, Now You Don't, which discussed the ongoing debate within the world of science and philosophy as to whether or not we really actually possess what we call in Hebrew, bechira, or in English we call it free will. Can we really choose to charter our own destiny in life? Or is it somehow in the stars? I don't know if any of you read your horoscope. Everybody's got a sign. And if you've got a certain sign, then you know, you have a certain tendency, and that tendency leads you into a certain place. Can we act independently to make decisions, or are we just slaves to our circumstances, whether they're genetic or environmental? And as I say, the world of psychology strongly is continuing to lean towards the view that we are basically products of our environment and of our backgrounds, and that we really can't or shouldn't expect ourselves or others to go beyond the culture, the philosophy, the environment in which we were raised. Does anybody know one area where everybody believes you can break through, though, in America? It's a very capitalist idea. Upward mobility, rags to riches. For some reason, when it comes to the economy, when it comes to money, everybody still believes that you can go from 0 to 60 and you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps and make yourself into something. Money, when it comes to money. But when it comes to virtually all other types of qualities, we seem to have developed this approach that wherever you are, the family... And by the way, there's some statistics that back this up, and I write this in the book, that despite the fact that many children of divorced parents promise and vow not to get divorced themselves, we know that statistically, most people who come from divorced families get divorced themselves. Research demonstrates that if one spouse comes from divorced parents, the couple's twice as likely to divorce. Spouses who are both children of divorced parents are three times as likely to divorce than other couples. Studies show that 80% of teens with gambling problems had at least one parent who gambled. Children of alcoholics are four more times likely to become alcoholics themselves. So if you keep doing these types of studies and keep seeing these types of results, you're going to be led to the conclusion that at the end of the day, maybe there's a crazy story of some guy in Parliament in Hungary who was an anti-Semite and now he's a Jew lover and becomes a Jew himself. But like, come on, he's the exception that proves the rule that ultimately people don't change. I mean, how many times have you gone out and then you'll ask somebody, is he a good guy? Right? Do you really believe, do we count on other people changing in life? Judaism very, very much believes in change. In fact, the whole high holiday period that we just went through, from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur to the whole Sukkot and Simchas Torah, what is all of that about, honestly? What were we doing in synagogue all day on Yom Kippur, doing, I did this wrong, I did that wrong, I'm going to do better here, I'm going to do better there. What is that? So how do you sort of reconcile that? And by the way, this is not a new problem. Take a look at the handout that I distributed. And if you can, I'm just going to ask you to do a little quick exercise. It's got two pages. Let's pop them apart right here. You with me? I want you to be able to see the Hebrew and the English. I want to read a little from Maimonides, the great Jewish philosopher. Those of you not familiar with Maimonides, he lived in Spain and then later in Egypt. And he said something very, very powerful. He was fighting against the predeterminists, the fatalists, the extreme astrologists who lived in his time. Follow with me. I'm going to read it in Hebrew, and I've got it in the English here on the right, or whichever place you're holding it. You guys with me? Okay, cool. Rishut l'chol adam netunah, he says. Permission has been given to all people. Im ratza la'atot atzmo l'derach tova v'liot tzadik. If a person wants to incline himself, if he desires, the English says here, to bend himself towards the good path, right? And to be a tzaddik. What's a tzaddik? A tzaddik is a righteous person. Harashut biyado, says the Rambam. Permission has been given to him. You want to be a righteous person, that's it. You can do it. V'im ratza latot atzmo l'derech ra'an, if you want to go just the opposite. V'liyot rashan, you want to become wicked. Harashut biyado, permission's also granted to you. How do we know this? And by the way, this is just from this last week's parsha. We just read this past Saturday in the Torah reading. Hu shekatuv b'Torah. It's written in the Torah. Hein ha'adam haya kechad mimenu ladat tov v'ra. When God creates man, he turns to his angels, and what does he say is special and different about man? This species of man, what does it say? Behold, the man is become one of us. How is he one of us? God is talking to the angels. He's not like the rest of the animals. Because what's the difference between people and animals? Free will. Okay, so I spoke a little about that on Shabbat. And I was talking about the whole Kavanaugh Ford situation about speaking and the way we speak. Right? So some say that what distinguishes man from animals is our communication ability. Even though some animals do communicate, the way human beings communicate demonstrates humans as intellectual beings, but here he's saying something different. He's saying we are different not because of our speech ability, but because of our ability to exercise free will. What does that mean to exercise free will? How's that different than animals? Yeah.
I was just going to ask, so how come like Adam is like distinguished from the animals? animals when they were created before he ate from the Ephodas and he got Kafira. We say that he was created on a different day. Why don't we just say that he was created with the wrong of the other animals? It seems to be that he had something special before he ate from the Ephodas.
Well, so it's funny, all of that man stuff took place on the sixth day. Animals preceded Adam's creation. And according to the commentaries, Adam had to get to know the animals first before he could recognize the need for an Eve and appreciate who she was. But I think that's precisely it. The fact that he's created on a different day is, I think, one of the ways of distinguishing him from the rest of the animal kingdom. He's not supposed to be like the rest. Because an animal, you ever hear like a dog? They say good dog, bad dog. Like, what does that mean, a good dog? There's no such thing as a good dog or a bad dog. There's a well-trained dog and there's a poorly trained dog, because animals, as lovable as they might be, are, how do they make decisions, we believe? From instinct. Now, we have instincts too, and we also could make decisions based on instinct. I don't know what you had for dinner tonight before the pizza, or maybe this was it. So if you ever choose, when they come over to you in the restaurant and they hand you two different things, you know, and you have to choose between these two items. So what are you using to distinguish between the two different items? This is how the rabbis talk about keeping kosher. Why is it a value to keep kosher? Because it's another way of distinguishing ourselves from the animal kingdom. An animal makes a decision as to what to eat, who to mate with, based on what? Pure instinct and instinct alone. People are supposed to be different. We are supposed to exercise free will. That doesn't mean it's not influenced by our instincts. We know we're heavily influenced by the physical part of who we are, but we believe we have the ability to prevail over the instincts. Klomar, in other words, let's keep going. Hein min zeh shel adam hayachid ba'olam. This species of man is singular and unique in the world. Ve'ein min domelo ba'zeh yinyan. And there's no other species that's similar to mankind in this regard. She'yehu ma'atzmo, that he himself, b'da'ato, b'machshavato, with his own knowledge, his own wisdom, yodea tov v'hara, he can tell the difference between good and evil. Now, by the way, so why do we sin? If we can tell the difference between right and wrong, then why do we mess up all the time? Cain kills his brother Abel in last week's parsha. Does anybody know what he tries to use as defense? He says, "Am I my brother's keeper?" But you know what he says right before that? Most people fluff over. He says, "Lo yadati, I don't know. Hashomer achi anochi, am I my brother's keeper?" A very interesting interpretation of that. What was he arguing? I don't know, am I my brother's keeper? Now, some say he was arguing two opposing defenses, which sometimes we do in a regular court of law. Maybe God's not omnipotent. Maybe he didn't see what I did. I don't know. I don't know what. Cain? I don't know. Maybe he's walking.
People say, I don't know. He gets them a question. Okay.
Right. I don't know. He buys you a little time. No, but some of the commentaries say that what he was claiming was, maybe I can get away with it. Maybe God didn't see. And if God did see, then I got my excuse. Am I my brother's keeper? But the Kliyakar, one of the classical commentators, reads it one. I don't know, am I my brother's keeper? Lo yadati, ashomer achi anochi. How am I supposed to know that murder is wrong? There's no rule book. There's no law book. The Torah wasn't given, not for centuries. So how am I supposed to know that murder was wrong? Does God buy that argument? By the way, it's a debate to this day. It's called natural philosophy. If I stuck you on a desert island and you had no proper influences, could you naturally intuit that something as bad as murder was wrong? What are you going to say?
Not having the Hebrew, but thinking about reason and thought in the text, and like in the quote, as opposed to instinct.
Yeah.
And kind of the source of where we get our ethics, because like I personally feel like we don't really know between good and evil. Like I think we distinguish a bit, and we can say, well, the Torah guides us in distinguishing between good and evil, but a lot of the times we can't, mostly because I think we're human and we're not all knowing. But so if we can't, or if we can see different sets of circumstances or, you know, effects for each of the actions that we do, and ultimately we choose incorrectly because we think, oh, this is the good one, but actually, you know,
mm-hmm.
or this is that we're doing is evil, but actually, I don't know, like, I think it's a little bit more confusing than that.
It is. I think you're expressing the classic Jewish approach is to say, we can't figure everything out ourselves. Why else did God give us this Torah?
Right.
Now, murder, and certain of the basics, some of the rabbis argue, you can. That you can naturally... What's that?
But that's actually very instinctive.
Right, for a human being. But others argue, no. And that, you know, if you were to put somebody on a desert island without any proper influences, maybe he or she would not figure out that murder was wrong. Maybe they would see other animals killing other animals and figure it's okay. You know? There's a debate. We don't have to resolve that debate. The most important thing coming out of this, according to the great Maimonides, and I'm trying to share with you, is that we can choose. Now, you and I are discussing, we're talking about, well, we can choose based on what? What we think in our minds or what's revealed in the Torah? Doesn't matter. The point is we can choose how to act based on decisions we want to make in life, what we think is right, whether it's coming from the Torah or it's coming from your gut.
And when God asked the one Adam and Eve, if they ate them, did you eat from the tree of knowledge, right? Then they thought it was a literal question, okay? They thought that then they collided, and maybe God didn't know
That's one interpretation. There are many, many different interpretations of that. But I think that's one of the points of the whole... I think that's one of the points of the whole story is that is Adam held responsible for his sin eating the fruit he wasn't supposed to eat from? Is he? Yeah, he's thrown out of the Garden of Eden. What happens to Cain after he kills his brother Hevel? Also held responsible. So this is very, very important. And that actually goes to another chapter in the book, which I don't want to get into now. That's chapter 4, the big difference between Judaism and Christianity, having to do with original sin. Whether or not we can be held responsible for our own actions, because do you need to place your faith in some other being? Because you're a born sinner. That's the classic Christian view. Judaism does not believe in that at all, even though we do believe this whole story of original sin comes from the Old Testament. It's the Torah. So clearly we have some concepts of this as well. But I don't want to get diverted on that.
Are you a born sinner then?
So we don't believe that. Jews don't believe we're born sinners. Jews believe that you can sin. Adam did. But you can redeem yourself. And you redeem yourself by doing what's called tshuva. Take a look at the top word on the page. Tshuva means repentance. If honestly we didn't believe that, then we wouldn't be coming to synagogue for the high holidays.
What does born sinner mean in Christianity?
It just means that no matter what you do at the end of the day, unless you place your faith in a being that hasn't been tainted by original sin, you will remain in sin. You need to be redeemed by someone that's not tainted by original sin.
So they believe you need a demigod to do tshuva, that's why they believe in Yeshua?
I don't know if it's a demagogue, but you need someone that's not tainted by original sin, obviously the belief is Jesus, and that he was born of Immaculate Conception and all that. So, but we don't subscribe to that view. We do believe we have an evil inclination and a positive inclination. We've got these opposing forces. You know, the little guy with the white halo smiling, and the little guy with the pitchfork, the devil or the demon in you. We do believe that within every human being we possess that. That was the effect of original sin, according to Judaism, by the way. Because the Kabbalists teach that before Adam sinned, he was almost like an angel. There was evil in the world, but it was represented by the serpent or the fruit. And when he ate the fruit, enticed by the serpent, he internalized the negative. And now we've got the negative. But the difference between Judaism and Christianity is that according to Judaism, even though we possess that negative, we don't believe we're controlled by it. We can be controlled by it, but we can control it if we want. In fact, that's what God tells Cain right before he kills his brother. Because he sees he was getting upset. He says, just remember, you have free will. because God knew what he was about to do. And he's like, just know that this is your decision. Catalina, you had a question?
Right? Because you're held responsible, or right, women suffer labor pains because of Eve's sin. Man is forced to toil the earth because of Adam's sin, and then also there's the idea that...
Yeah, there is a certain level of collective responsibility. I guess that's a fair point.
The father is responsible for his son's sin.
Well, it's a little different. Parents are responsible for their children. Anybody know until what age?
13.
That's a crazy blessing that dads say when their boys turn bar mitzvah. I was just at a bar mitzvah. My father got up and said, Baruch shepitrani me'unshel zozeh. Blessed is God who exempted me. I'm no longer held accountable. This kid's on his own kind of thing. You know what I mean? So they say girls 12, boys 13. So there is, it's a little different with parents. We are held responsible for each other. You know, I think that's one of the reasons why when we pray, it's always in the plural. Because we pray on behalf of other people, because we know at the end of the day, we share this planet. We like to think everything we do is independent of others, but there's almost nothing we can do that doesn't affect other people, whether we like it or not. So on some level, we are held responsible. I know that doesn't always seem so fair. We're definitely off on a tangent. Okay, I'm coming back now. So that's okay. This is all relevant, kind of. So look at source number 2 on your page from Maimonides. So the Rambam goes on to say that mankind is different. And he goes on in number 2, he says, permit not your thought to dwell upon that which ridiculous fools of other peoples and a majority of asinine individuals among the children of Israel say. And he was very opinionated by Maimonides. He said, lots of people in the world believe this, including lots of Jews. That what? That the Holy One, blessed is He, decrees at the very embryonic state of every man whether he should be just or wicked. And he says it's not so. Every human being is capable of being as just as Moses or as wicked as Yeravam. Yeravam was a terrible tyrant in the days of the prophets who oppressed the Jewish people. And he says that every person is capable of being as great as Moses or as wicked as Yeravam. Wise, I don't know what Ikoni is, his translation is. Wise or foolish, merciful or human, miser or philanthropist, and so in all other tendencies. I'm going to read in the Hebrew, it's easier. It says, Chacham or Sachal, Rachman or Chzai. Rachman is a merciful, Achzari is like a cruel person, or Kilai or Shoah. Right? You can literally be anything. And there is none to either force things upon him or to decree things against him, either to pull him one way or to draw him another way. But he alone, of his own free will, with the consent of his mind, bends to any path. And this is a polemic. Maimonides was arguing against the fatalists, the extreme astrologists of his day and age, who were claiming that no matter what you did in life, I mean, the Greeks believed in fate. Right, all the Greek plays are all about fate. No matter what they try to do, they can't break out of their fate. Judaism believes in free will. Problem is the last source on the page. Take a look at the last source, which is a story in the Talmud. The story tells us in the Talmud, in the Tractate of Nida, page 16d, Rav Chananya bar Papa made the following exposition, a great Talmudic sage. It says, the name of the angel who's in charge of conception is called Night. I have it in the Hebrew. I'm just going to read it in the Hebrew. It says, Oso malach ha-mamun al-rayon laila shemo. There's an angel who's in charge of pregnancy. And the angel's name is Laila. V'notel tipa. And this angel comes along and takes what's called a tipa. U'mamida lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Tipa is a drop. What does it say in the English here? So Rashi, the commentary, tells us that it's talking about a drop of sperm. That the angel comes along with a drop of sperm, stands before God and says, Ribbono shel Olam, Master of the Universe, Tipa zu, ma tehei aleha. This drop, what will become of it? Gibor or chalash, strong or weak? Chacham or tipesh, smart, wise or foolish? Ashir, rich or ani, or poor? Stop. Is this a problem, according to everything we've said, or is this consistent? big problem. Why is it a big problem? As this seems to imply, that even before the sperm has fertilized the egg and formed a person, the angel is already finding out what it's going to be. Is this person going to grow up to be a rich person or poor? A wise person or foolish? Like, what does that mean? What do you mean? What happened to free will? Can anyone tell me before you keep reading? I hope you didn't read because the answer is the next line. Can anyone tell me what the answer to this? Has he said anything that actually contradicts free will yet?
No.
Why not?
Talking about circumstances.
Very good. Just because some people end up being very wealthy and some not. Some people look like this and some people look like that. Some people, what are the examples? Are more intelligent, some people are less intelligent. Are those products of free will? Now, on some level, you can tweak some of those things. You go to the gym after a while, maybe you can build yourself up a little more. You go to school, apply yourself. But we all know that some of this is genetic, right? It's based on you're born in your gene pool, intelligence, build, those kind of things. You can tweak it, but a lot of this is really circumstantial. How is it not inconsistent? How is it still consistent, this Gemara? Because look at the next line. V'ilu rasha l'tzadik lo ka'amar. The angel, Lila, takes this drop and never asks God, will this drop turn into a person who becomes a tzaddik, a person who's righteous, or, what's the opposite, or wicked? Why? And the very famous line from the Talmud, Amar Rav Chananya, Kol Bidei Shemayim, everything is in God's hands, Chutz Mirat Shemayim, except for what? The fear of God. What does that mean? Everything is in God's hands, except for the fear of God. What's the fear of God? The fear of God is your values. It's what you believe in. And in a sense, Hashem controls everything. But one little thing He doesn't control, and that one little thing, and I'm using the word little facetiously, that one little thing is what ultimately gives us free will. Because what really matters in life, at least as far as Judaism is concerned, what you look like, how much money you make, how much weight you can bench in the gym, what really matters? What matters are the ethical value decisions that we make in our lives. And that, says the Talmud, the angel never asks. You know why? Because that is up to you. And that's where free will is. And that's the only part of life that Judaism really cares about so much. I'm not saying it doesn't matter whether you're a doctor, a lawyer, or you drive a bus. It probably matters a lot more in this material, physical world than it does in the heavenly realm, because we're not evaluated on what we do to earn a living. What we're really evaluated on is how we go about practicing whatever profession we're in. What kind of lawyer are you? What kind of doctor? What kind of bus driver? Do you give back proper change? Do you wish your patients good morning? Do you represent your client with integrity? It's not what you do, it's how you do it. It's not the deck of cards. Because guess what? You and I have very little control over the deck of cards. And the irony of ironies is that in our society, we spend all the time trying to manipulate the deck of cards to change the deck. I don't like the way I look, I don't like the way I this, I don't like blah, 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 blah. Instead, and this is not so easy, embracing the deck of cards, whatever it is, and doing the best that I can do with what I've been given. That's the way we're evaluated as far as classical Judaism is concerned. Not what you do, but how you do it. And Esther Youngreis of blessed memory used to say, she gave the example of the lawyer, the doctor, the cab driver. She always said that was what was really important was what kind of individual are you. Not the deck of cards. I write in the book that the well-known existential psychiatrist and Holocaust survivor Viktor Frankl wrote in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, that this was precisely what the Nazis were trying to prove in the concentration camps. They were trying to prove that human beings are just a higher rung of animals. They were evolutionists. They believed that the Aryan race was a superior race. And they were trying to demonstrate that if you can take a person and put them in a particular set of circumstances and you can control their behavior. And Viktor Frankl wrote that every time a Jew gave up their bread rations for someone else, they disproved what the Nazis, what Hitler was trying to prove. He said, and I quote, we who lived in concentration camps can remember the men who walked through the huts comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances. This is the only thing I could ever say to someone when they come to me with a problem in life, where you got dealt a really awful deck of cards. Something goes bad in life. And I can't change that. And I'm not in control of it. We can pray to change it, and you should. But compared to the reality itself, we can choose the attitude that we apply to that new deck of cards. And that can make a big, big difference. If we can't control the what of our lives, the stuff that happens, the how actually can matter. And one of the stories I tell, wind down, of a Dr. Rachman Melamed Cohen. I know he's got a long name. He had six beautiful kids. He was already a grandfather, and he had a senior position in Israel in the Ministry of Education. He had already published two critically acclaimed books, and then when he was making Kiddush on a Friday night with his family, celebrating Shabbat, he felt weakness in his left shoulder. The Kiddush cup shook, and when the wine spilled, and then they started going to doctors, him and his wife, and he realized that he had Lou Gehrig's disease. The doctor outlined the very fatal course of this disease, and he became paralyzed. His lungs stopped working. And the doctor told him, you're going to be dependent on someone else, and your life is basically over. And that was about 15 years ago. It's an unbelievable personality. Although he became completely paralyzed, can only communicate through a program which tracks his eye movements, he starts off his each and every day by davening, by praying. He goes to work, where he has continued to be consulted by people throughout the world on a myriad of educational issues. He's an expert in education. He mastered Photoshop, which allows him to paint with his eyes, and he, to this day, debates Israeli advocates of euthanasia, because it's all about the attitude. And he's authored 8 new books since he got sick. 8 new books. And it's an unbelievable example of how someone who got a really awful deck of cards dealt, but his attitude, his approach, the way he dealt with that deck of cards was just exceptional. We very, very much believe that every situation we're placed in life, we're placed in that situation for a reason. We don't always want it. We'd prefer that maybe somebody else got that situation. But if it's happening, it's happening for a reason. This is the opinion of the Ramchal, Rabbeinu Moshe Chaim Lutzatel, that if you're in a situation, you're in it for a reason. You went on a date with someone. What the heck was this person thinking about? Why would anyone fix me up with such an individual? You were supposed, if you're there, you were supposed to be there. Do something positive with the situation. Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say, never ask the question why. Because we don't have a good answer. Why is this thing happening? There might be reasons, but we may not be privy to those reasons. But what? That's the question you should ask. Because what can I do with this terrible circumstance? How can I somehow learn to grow? Or maybe I can help this other person, this miserable being I'm on a date with. Maybe they need my help. I don't know. There's got to be some reason that this happened. Because if it happened, and you were there, and you could say, oh yeah, well that was a mistake. Right. You're in the mistake. What are you doing with the mistake now? It's a very, very important lesson. We very much believe that everything happens for a reason. The last story, I don't think I'm going to tell it because it's like so long. You'll have to get the book for this. I have to leave you with a little tease. It's an unbelievable story about a guy in the KKK in the early 1990s and a cantor in the synagogue in Omaha, Nebraska, who developed an extraordinary relationship with, again, the concept of change. I try to bring up radical examples of change so that people actually believe it's possible. But I want to end with one last idea, because at the end of the day, it all comes down to believing in yourself. You can break out of the box, but you've got to believe in yourself enough. And this is something that our generation suffers from tremendously. We struggle tremendously with self-confidence and with self-esteem. There was a story of a professor, I heard this many years ago, and I love this story, and he stood before his class of about 30 senior molecular biology students, and he was about to pass out the final exam, and they're all uptight about taking the test, and he says, and I quote, "I've been privileged to be instructor this semester. I know how hard you've all worked to prepare, and I know that most of you are off to medical school or graduate school next fall. And I'm aware of how much pressure you all are under to keep your GPAs up. And because I know that you're all capable of understanding the material, I'm prepared to offer an automatic B to anyone who would prefer not to take the final. If you don't want to take the final, you get a B, just get up and walk out right here and right now." You're shaking your head, you wouldn't do it. So what happened? A whole bunch of students just, they were like, oh, it's amazing. They just got up and walked. They made a beeline for the door. And there were a couple of students, like five or six students left. And he looked at this handful of students, and he says, any other takers, last chance. One more student got up and walked out. And there were actually seven students remained. The professor closed the door. He took attendance. Then he handed out the final exam, which had two sentences typed on the top. Congratulations, you just received an A. Keep believing in yourself. And I really believe that this is the recipe for the free will. We do believe in free will. A lot of people don't want to believe in free will, because if you believe in free will, then that puts a lot of responsibility on yourself. If you believe, you're held responsible for your actions, and it's not simply about putting your faith in someone else or something else. Now, we believe in believing in God, but ultimately our belief in God teaches us that we have to do what we can do. We just need God's guidance through His Torah to follow the right path in life. At the end of the day, there are no easy way outs in Judaism. People often turn to religion because they want a simple, easy way out. Every other part of life is complicated. Every other part of life is pushing me to do this and pushing me to do that. Unfortunately, that's what Judaism wants. Judaism wants us to believe enough in ourselves that we are going to choose the right path and follow the right path. Be much simpler. Open up the horoscope. Oh, I'm a Leo. Leos are this. I'm good with that, or I'm not good with that. I don't have to do anything. I'm just too tired from everything else in my life. That's not believing in yourself. That's getting up and taking the B. God wants us to take the A, but the only way we can do that is to sufficiently believe. So I end the chapter by saying that we only get one shot in life. Let's make sure that we don't sell ourselves short by not expecting more from ourselves than what we did yesterday. Today's a new day, and since change is possible, and here's the problem, because change is possible, we have to get better. If we didn't believe change was possible, then we wouldn't have that pressure. But as the founder, the great Zionist thinker and founder of modern-day Zionism, Theodor Herzl, famously said, he said in Hebrew, Im tirtze, ein zu agada. He says, if you will it, it will not remain a dream. You can turn a dream into reality, but you've got to really want it. You've got to really go after it. And I think that's one of the reasons why. I know there are some who, for pure philosophical reasons, don't believe in free will. Albert Einstein was such an individual. Most people who don't subscribe to the concept of free will, in my opinion, just don't want to have to kill themselves to be better and actually believe that if you do better, you can be better. And you can break out of a bad habit, of whatever it is that's keeping us imprisoned and that's keeping us behaving in the same kind of way. I can keep babbling on, but I want this to be a conversation. Yeah.
So related to the last point you just made. So I know someone who runs a group on the illusion of free will. And I've gone to these multi-hour conversations and debated the hell out of it as a proponent of free will. And as a quick side, I've gone to Kabbalah lectures and they say it's not purely free will. We believe that both are happening. The free will and that you don't have free will, both happening at the same time, which got confusing. Now, but the
no, I if you don't mind me tweaking that,
sure.
I don't know the lecture you went to.
Sure.
The one thing that has to be reconciled with our belief in free will is that God has a plan, and that's what Maimonides and a lot of the philosophers and capitalists discuss. How do you reconcile our belief in free will that you and I can choose, and yet God has this plan for the universe, for the world, for all people, and it happens to be the decisions you make, the choices you make, somehow fit into God's overall plan.
Yes. So thank you for that.
Okay, sure.
So what he continuously would just point out in front of the group is that Einstein, Freud, Charles Darwin, these were like masters of mind, all didn't believe in free will.
Correct.
So
Spinoza.
If they didn't believe in free will, why do you believe in free will? So, like, what do you say to
Well, for
what
every.
Do you say to
that's not an argument. Just because a lot of smart people don't believe in something doesn't mean they were right. There are a lot of really smart, scholarly people who did believe in free will, like Maimonides.
Fair. And that's what I would say. That's what I would
you
say
have to debate it on the merits, not on the personalities. So, you have to ask yourself whether or not you believe you can actually control the things going on in life, or are you just part of a play? Are you just some little puppet in some play? That's being played out and you're playing a certain part. No matter what you do, at the end of the day, you're just playing some part that's already been written. Now, I ultimately believe in this because it's what the Torah teaches. Because we are in it, by definition, we are the worst people to make this decision. You understand? We're part of the whole situation. And you can't objectively decide whether or not you have really free will or not. I personally go for it because I believe in the Torah. And I believe that the Torah is an expression of God's will. And the Torah makes it abundantly clear that we have free will. All of the stories in the Torah are people messing up. I mean, why is Hitler bad? Why would you consider anyone evil if that's the way they were hardwired, or they're just playing some part? I would just feel bad for them that they got a bad part. Who wants to play the villain? I want to play the hero. No, he's bad, he's evil, because Hitler could have used his brilliance and his incredible oratory skill, not to hurt people, but to build Germany up in a positive way. And instead, he was responsible for the death of 100 million people. I'm not really sure how Spinoza and Einstein and these guys explain someone like that, but the extreme form of not believing in free will is to say it's a complete abdication of human responsibility.
Yeah.
No one is responsible for anything because you're just playing something out. You can't help it. That's your horoscope. That's your, you know. Yeah.
Circumstances that of free will cannot overcome? Like, is it possible to think about that that way, right? That you could be someone who struggles with, like,
yes,
alcoholism or depression.
Yeah.
And you try very hard and you exercise as often as possible, positive thinking and
yes,
resisting all these things.
100%.
I
mean, we know that because we have what's the defense in the United States called? We have an insanity defense.
Mm-hmm. We don't if it's like there's an insanity defense, but now there's also like a strain of science that says like addiction can be cured biologically. It's hormonally or it's something in your brain, and if we just fix that one part in your brain, then you won't be addicted. And so if someone is addicted to something especially evil, like child pornography, it's not even
right,
their fault.
Right.
Could you argue, though, that the resilience itself is sort of an expression of free will? The idea of trying to...
It is. The question is, if let's say science becomes convinced that a certain type of personality tendency is completely chemically based, completely... I don't know if there is such a thing. You know, I've gave this example many times. I still get a little addicted to Law and Order. If you can watch Law and Order till you're like 3 in the morning, you can watch 42 episodes every night. And so there was a great Law and Order. What was the Law and Order episode? I actually Googled it. It was true. Some of these stories are based on real cases, and it was a kid on a hockey team, and a really good hockey team, and the scouts came from the colleges to recruit, and for some reason the coach pulled out this kid while the scouts were there, and he didn't get a chance to strut his stuff. The father went ballistic, and he attacked the coach, and didn't mean to kill him, but he meant to hurt him, and he killed him. And he was brought up on charges of manslaughter. And the defense lawyer, argued that he could not be held responsible for the death because he had terrible rage issues and anger problems. And given the circumstances, how much was riding on that hockey game for his kid, and the father's da-da-da. Now, the jury didn't buy it, and the father was convicted of manslaughter. But that's an example of how, listen, it's being used in political...
But that's in a case that we think that it's completely outside of your control.
No, but it's not. In other words, I don't...
Like, but if you think you have some control over it, but it just... Right, but it...
If you have some control, then you're held somewhat responsible.
Right.
There might be mitigating circumstances in the sentencing. They might reduce the sentence because of... But they're going to still be held guilty. Listen, I remember in the Second Intifada, that's what was being written up in all sorts of mainstream newspapers. What else can you expect of someone who's deprived of their political rights than for that person to go into a movie theater and blow themselves up? I mean, and that's why you have to be very, very careful. The belief in free will is a fundamental belief that needs to be maintained in the world. Because if we don't, we then abdicate human responsibility, and we can justify almost anything, because we can say, well, what choice do they have? What choice does a person in the concentration camps have? They're being treated like an animal. It's okay for them to, so they can kill somebody else and take their potatoes. That's not permissible.
Are we judged based on effort or based on results?
I mean, I think it's a combination, and I think everything gets taken into account. But I'm not sure how that's...
Like, I think, I'm going to make an analogy, and it's not perfect, but like when we think about obesity or weight, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are people who, and if you think about genetics and circumstances, there are people who can try your hardest to exercise every day,
right,
to limit your diet every day. You can take all the necessary steps, but
right,
because of it, certain things are outside of your control,
right,
you'll never lose the weight, you'll never, whatever.
That might be from a physiological perspective, that might be true, but let's... But let's make sure that we distinguish between circumstantial things and value judgments. Losing weight is not a value judgment, even though a person's perspective in life might be, might influence how the person diets. But some of it is just biological.
I'm talking about making ethical decisions. That's the only area that free will applies. That's really important. Free will does not apply to how much money you make. Free will does not apply to what we look like, how we form our bodies or anything like that. Obviously, the word free will sounds like it applies to that, but in Judaism, that's not a free will moment.
We should just say something regarding that, mm-hmm. right? For instance, does one have free will, right, if they're addicted to something or other? It's not like they're going to do it, and can they stop doing it? I mean, do they have a choice? I mean, can they choose? Okay. It's like you're going to do it. It's like this, and this bottle of alcohol, and alcohol, if it's something they're going to do, they're going to drink the alcohol.
Right, but let's face it, if a person is so addicted, at some point their free will has been greatly compromised. But I don't necessarily consider that a free will example. Unless what can keep them from getting back into the bad habit is a value. The value of, let's say, being healthy. The value of taking control over your life. So maybe those are good examples. Maybe the dieting is a good example of that.
People have been thinking so many times and they've said that they had to get angry. They have no choice but to get angry.
Right, it's harder. Maimonides, by the way, wrote that people have different dispositions. But just because you have aggressive tendencies doesn't mean you have zero control over your temper. Now, is it much more difficult? 100%. And that is the danger in our society. We keep getting closer and closer to finding everyone's looking for a gene for something, for everything.
Well, but so basically, it's like it becomes very naturally to you to be good, right? To like keep certain commandments and but you don't have to try very hard. It's very easy.
In some areas, there's no such thing. Being good is a
right.
very broad
it's easy
thing.
For but, something else, you know?
Right, but
if certain parts of being good.
If you struggle with it all the time, but you improved over time. Mm-hmm.
Correct. But that doesn't matter because we're not being evaluated objectively. We're being evaluated according to who we are. We are evaluated in life based on who we are. Why else could Maimonides say that any human being could be as great as Moses? How could I be as great as Moses? I don't have his prophetic vision.
Because
the understanding classically is that I can get as close to my potential or even closer to my potential as Moses got to his potential. That's what's important in life. It's not objective. It's who you are, what your potential is. I just want to make sure everyone else gets a chance. Yeah.
So this is probably a much longer conversation, but you touched on it. Is the reconciling of the fact that, so we have free will, but Hashem has a plan.
Yeah.
Is the reconciling of that God does know what we're going to do, but we do have the power for tshuva,
yes.
etc., to change the course that God originally set
mm-hmm.
for our lives?
Yeah, Maimonides seems to answer that. Because God does not operate within the human dimensions of time and space. So God's well aware of all the decisions that you're going to be making in your life. But that doesn't mean he's controlling them. I like to use like the weatherman approach. Like if you look tonight, what's the weather? Today, yucky, it was yucky weather today. So you want to know, is it going to be yucky and humid tomorrow? So let's say 80% humidity. No, 80% chance that it's going to rain, let's say. And let's say it rains. So the weatherman, no one believes that the weatherman caused it to rain because the weatherman predicted with an 80% confidence that it was going to rain. So God has 100%. God's completely aware of all the factors, all the circumstances. He knows everything. Is a weird thought, but like he sees us in our mother's wombs, right now having this discussion with each other, and in our graves, all at the same time. And that's why the rabbis, it's a verse in the Torah, the prophets, Ki lo machshavotai machshavotechem, that God's mind and our minds are not the same. This is why it's difficult, because we're trying to project towards the divine, and we're just not. So it actually, God can know everything that's going to happen without actually affecting our ability to choose. And that's the most important thing as far as Judaism is concerned, that you and I can freely choose. And that's why we have to have the good and the bad at our disposal. If we don't have access to both, then we don't have free will.
Nobody can be as good as Moses, but one can be as loving as Moses.
No, Maimonides believed you can be better than Moses,
because, this is my understanding, it's all about reaching your potential. So if Moses, you know, objectively went way further than I could ever get, but the differential between Moses' actual and Moses' potential is less than the differential between Wilde's actual and potential, I'm greater. That's one explanation anyway. Yeah.
According to your view, do you think that we have free will, or do you think Judaism has free will, believes in free will for our thoughts or only our actions? So if we like have a certain opinion or like think like, oh, I hate this person, just, you know, do we have free will unless we're held responsible for that thought, or is it only our actions?
So I would distinguish between an emotion and a thought. I think it would be very hard pressed to say that we have control over our thoughts. Total control. We have some control over our thoughts. Emotions are different because the Torah does prohibit jealousy. The Torah does prohibit bearing a grudge. Now you'll say, how? How can the Torah do that? You either feel it or you don't. I hate his guts, and that's just the way I feel. You know, the Torah very much believes that feelings are the product of certain types of thoughts and behaviors, and that you can actually rein those in. I don't know if anybody knows the difference between jealousy and bearing a grudge. You know, anybody know the difference between, yeah?
Jealousy, you want the light of somebody else, mm-hmm. whether their entire life is significant, bearing the grudges, not forgiving them for something wrong.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a little more practical difference. So jealousy is where it is exhibited in action. You didn't do something for me, I'm not going to do it for you. Bearing a grudge is, even though you didn't do this thing for me, I'm still going to do it for you, but you're walking around with something. You're still feeling something, but it's not playing itself out in action. Either way, we're supposed to, I mean, the Torah wants us, that's the debate between Maimonides and Nachmanides about belief in God. How can you mandate belief? Nachmanides says you can. The other way. Maimonides says you can. Nachmanides disagrees and says you cannot. It's sort of axiomatic. He doesn't consider the first of the Ten Commandments a commandment. He just says it's a given, if you will. But, you know, it says in the Torah, "Lo tisnat achicha b'vecha," you shall not harbor hate for your brother in your heart. So how do you not harbor hate for someone? I mean, I'm just curious. How would you go about ridding your heart of hate?
That jealousy is at the root of hatred?
I mean, they're connected, but the Torah treats them separately. Jealousy is more wanting, like you were saying, what someone else has. Hatred is broader. You hate the person. But the Torah expects us to rein that in somehow. Any ideas? Forgiveness, good. And we don't, right? Forgiveness, good. What else? It's actually, by the way, I'm sorry, it's actually in the verse that the Torah tells us not to hate. It tells us to speak out. If you're upset about something, say something. A surefire way of developing, I don't want to use the word hatred, it's very, but like ill will, which eventually can become hatred, is by keeping quiet when someone offends you, when someone does something. So the Torah says, "Ochiach tochiach et amitecha," that you should rebuke your friend. Some of these things are not very politically correct. It's like, what do you mean? I'm supposed to tell him he did something wrong? Again, if you don't get used to telling other people when they do something to offend you, then you should probably start getting used to hating a lot of people. Because that's what's going to happen. What's that? It's Leviticus chapter 19, verse 16, technically. It says in the Torah, "Lo tisnat achicha belvavecha," do not harbor hate for your brother. "Ochech tochech atamitecha," thou shalt surely rebuke him. "Velo tisa lavchet," and do not bear sin because of him. And everyone debates, what is do not bear sin? And some say it's the sin of keeping quiet. Are you going to say something,
yeah,
Michael?
So yeah. I was just wondering, is there a certain book or, say, manual that many rabbis have been read on that Jews in general
could use
to increase one's free will, like earlier in life, or like is there?
What does that mean? Increase your free will? Increase your belief in your free will?
Increase your belief in your free will. Is there like have rabbis agreed like, hey, this is a good book to give kids, or young adults?
That's a great question. I'm trying to think of what would be a good Jewish book. I mean, I would start with the Torah because, I mean, I don't mean to sound like trite, but the Torah is just filled with stories. If you look at the book of Genesis, the whole first of the five books of Genesis, it's all about taking responsibility. Because look at the stories. Adam, last week's parsha. What happens when God tells him, you did something wrong, what does he do? What does he say? He points to Eve. She told me to do it. And what does Eve do? She points to the snake. He told me to do it. Right? What happens with Cain? Am I my brother's keeper? I mean, this keeps going on.
But I think,
no, so I would just, I'm just saying one simple thing. If you read the stories of the Torah, there's a lot of this there.
But I would say that the stories are harder to read because they can be read in either direction.
Of course.
And that's
the
well, I don't know. The simple reading of some of these stories all lead towards personal responsibility. I think they're pretty straightforward. But. That's a little more.
Or not God approves or not, and I think
God approves of what the brothers did.
Yeah, by killing all of
it's them. It's unclear.
And it's very unclear. Yeah. You can look at the text and you can say, well, this happened, so God approves, or this, but or you can read
right.
The sentence slightly different if God doesn't approve. So I think the story.
I would never give the story of Dina as an example of free will, of you know. But you're right. I mean, there are a lot of stories that are a little more confusing, but the first five or six stories of the Bible are all like take responsibility, you know?
Yeah. I think something more practical is maybe Pirkei Avot, which has more like directions.
Certain sayings, yeah, that's a good idea. It's not about free will per se, but they teach you again to take responsibility. A lot of motivational. It doesn't even have to be Jewish. There's a lot of great motivational works out there that kind of demonstrate people's abilities. And I think those help too.
What was the name of that guy?
Rachamim Cohen is his name. It's in the book in chapter 9. His name was Dr. You can Google him. Oh, really?
I didn't know his name.
He's extraordinary. Dr. Rachamim Malamed Cohen. Cohen, Dr. Cohen.
Thank you.
That's a little easier. Any other comments, questions, insights, debates? Yes. What was your first name again?
Eric.
Eric. Takes me a few times, sorry.
I'm Eric. I became Jew later on in my
Zagetti.
My grandparents were actually Hungarian Holocaust survivors.
Wow.
And they always talked about growing up in Hungary and that there was always a lot of jealousy, sometimes from God, Jewish, Hungarians. Because, oftentimes, Jewish families are sometimes be more successful, more educated, all of that. And I kind of feel like jealousy, in a lot of ways, may not be, may not cause hatred, but it certainly, sows the seed for people.
Do you think that was really the reason?
Well, I'm saying it.
It was there.
It gives the root.
It was there.
It gives the seeds, and then I think people become, when they have the opportunity to express that jealousy, it turns into hatred in the actions. And I think that's, in a way, how it manifested. The Holocaust was a manifestation of a lot of jealousy.
Even though what the Nazis were arguing was just the opposite, you realize. In other words, they were trying to demonstrate that we were an inferior people. That's the craziness of anti-Semitism. Some people say it's because, you're arguing, and it was to some degree based on jealousy. And other people were like, they're a despised, vermin of a people. Unless you really believe that was just masking a real, I don't know. I don't think there's any real rational basis for any form of bigotry. I think at the end of the day, it's just hatred. And the evidence to me is that you literally have contradictory reasons why people hate Jews in different times. The Nazis were saying, they're taking over, they're getting too close. You remember what Haman had to say in the times of the Purim story? How he convinced Ahasuerus. He said that these people are not good, loyal citizens. They keep to themselves. They've got their own rules. They're not integrated in our society. Hitler said just the opposite. He says they're taking over the banks. They're marrying our children. They're taking, you know, it's too much. So, you know, you could trace anti-Semitism in every generation. All of a sudden, there's like a different reason. Which to me means that there is no real, like, rational reason. You know, I don't think it's necessarily different than other people's. I don't know why people hate. Why was there why is there racism and bigotry to black people, to other? I don't. You know, people give reasons, and those reasons are true, but are they the real? Are they really the reason? You know. That's another reason. They're getting too close, you know. But if you're jealous, could it be fear? You know, they seem to contradict each other. Yeah. Okay, I don't want to keep you guys here all night. Thank you all for joining. Next week, we are going to continue. I forgot my topic for next week. Oh, good. It's my favorite. It's even better than this one. This is a good one to start with. It's a little more philosophical, lays the groundwork. Next week we're going to talk about going from object to subject and not being an object in life in general. It actually is very much connected with what we're seeing in the whole Me Too movement and what's going on with the Kavanaugh. I wrote, by the way, if anyone's interested, my words up from my sermon on Shabbat in a blog, if anybody wants to take it before you go. But that is actually, it's a little connected. I think it is very much connected to what's happening as well today. So I hope to see you guys next week. If anybody wants a book,
yeah,
talk to Hillary.
One, if you want to get a book, come see me, if you're inspired. And two, if I could have everyone stand by the sign.
Are we taking a picture?
Yeah.
A group photo, excellent. And there's cold pizza left, if anybody wants. There's nothing like cold pizza.
Sorry,
I'm
going to be in LA.
Yeah.
For Orange County.
Yeah, you know what? Do me a favor.
Everyone go towards the sign.
Perfect start, I think. Because I think it's all a function of how much you believe you
can. I know that.
Everything else is a function of how much you believe.
Okay, everyone
to
the sign.
All right.
Can I move this thing? Would it be worth it to move this thing?
Actually, no, leave it. We need the empty side.
My iPhone is only like so big. Okay, my iPhone's like this big. Ready? Squish. Make rows. I was like, my iPhone can't back up. Yeah, rows.
I left the thing here if you want a little MJ thing in there. Do you want it?
Oh, for the book?
No, in the front. The logo in the front of the
book. Yes, got it.
Okay, cool.
Kay. Ready, everyone? But you guys are, do you want to come
join
me? Sorry.
Right, so.
Just want to make sure.
I don't know, when did Superman show up?
Perfect.
Special
okay.
Position for you.
Okay, ready? One, two, three. One more. Awesome. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Guys, thanks
and
for proposing.
Wine and pizza this we're
going to go to. Guys, there's more food. Please take. Yeah. We don't want to get rid of the pizza.
Oh, Thank you.
Good night. Just put this on Deborah's desk.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
Maybe more pizza.
Pizza? There's a whole bunch of kitchen on the counter.
Thank you.
want me to bring these books up?
If you want. I normally put them on a shelf in there. I was going to bring them upstairs.
Right. Okay, let's do that.
Thank you. plan?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. else.